This tape is produced and distributed by the Christian Biblical Church of God, Post Office Box 1442, Hollister, California, 95024-1442. For the Canadian office and offices overseas, listen at the end of the tape, please. Our website is www.cbcg.org. Well, this morning, we're going to cover something that I've been going over. How many here get the journal? Oh, quite a few of you. Okay. There's always a question as to its worth. But at least what it does, it lets you know what others are doing, if nothing else. In discussing this, we have chosen not to get involved with the journal. However, with so many things going on with the calendar and tithing and now the nature of God, perhaps we need to go ahead and at least state the truth. I don't really relish the idea of getting in the journal, but I hate to see so many brethren led astray by so many silly things that go on. And one of them is there's a big advertisement there. Ken Westby and the Association for Christian Development and Anthony Buzzard and Charles Hunting are having a conference concerning the nature of Christ. And I graduated with Ken from Ambassador College. We both graduated in 64. And so I wrote him a letter and I told him I thought he was going down the wrong path. And he sent that on to Charles Hunting, and Charles Hunting sent me some things. And so I answered him. And I guess he's still stuck in the hierarchical evangelistic mode because he asked me to answer him with respect. So after I challenged him on some of his doctrines, I said, respectfully yours. Because when people come up with false doctrine, you cannot respect that kind of thing at all. I was straightforward to the point. And so years ago when I did Who is Jesus? So it was 88 and 89 because it was quite a lengthy series. And at that time I had Anthony Buzzard's booklet. And now they have this book, The Doctrine of the Trinity, Christianity's Self-Inflicted Wound by Anthony Buzzard and Charles Hunting. And it's amazing what they have put in here. It is really not a full treatise against the Trinity. It is more a treatise against Christ having been God before he was human. And in Anthony's booklet, he said that Christ was thoroughly Jewish, brought up in a Jewish way, meaning in Judaism. See, now that's where we got the flap the other night, because Judaism is not the law of Moses. Now, I've mentioned it many times, but I'll mention it here again. In order to understand Judaism and the works of law, you have to have the book, The Code of Jewish Law. See? And when you read that, then it will become crystal clear as to why Judaism is not what God taught. So when they talk about return to Jewishness, they're talking about returning to Judaism. And as I pointed out yesterday, In the series I did, Jesus in Prophecy, going through Arnold Fruchtenbaum's book on it, which was very good. And he is a Jew. Right? And his mission is to Jews. And he thoroughly understands about Elohim, explains it just the way that we understand it. He thoroughly understands that the prophecies in the Old Testament show that the one who became Jesus Christ was God before he became flesh. Now, there is a whole movement to Judaize all of Christianity and bring it back under the hegemony of Judaism, and then let all of the Gentiles follow the Noahide laws, which, by the way, the International Criminal Court, the basis of it is the Noahide laws, in case you didn't know that, you see. And that's already in effect now. So what we're going to do, we're going to look at some scriptures in the Old Testament, and then we will basically go through the book of John. Now, you see, let's go to Genesis, the first chapter, and let's ask a question as we're turning there. How many times does God have to say something for it to be true? Once. Now, scholars take this position, and I'm convinced that 90% plus of the scholars are non-believers, if not atheists. And the worst of the lot are those from the Jesus Seminar who, you know, desire to tear down everything about Christ. And yet there are churches that actually affiliate with Jesus Seminar, hundreds of them. So you see where everything is going in the world under what is called religion and under what is called Christianity. Now let's start Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, now I'm starting here because when we get to the first part of John, that's where we will be. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth. Now I'll just briefly review the word God, which is Elohim, which is a plural noun meaning more than one. Eloa means one. God. Okay. And this is shown when we come to Genesis 1:26. Genesis 1:26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." Now the "us" refers to God. The Jews explained this. The "us" refers to the council of angels that were with God when he created. But it doesn't say that. Now let me stop here and explain to you Judaism's view of God. And Judaism does believe in monotheism, meaning only one God by number. They do not understand one by unity or one family, meaning more than one by number. And the reason is because how many here were subjected to Stavronides' thoughts? Okay, a lot of you. Okay. God is everywhere. Okay. God has no form. Now, if you want a whole sermon on that, you can write for the tape, "God is a glob." Okay? Because they say God has no form, God has no arms, no hands, no head, no feet, no body. God is everywhere. Therefore, God is, you can't really describe him. See? So therefore, because God is everywhere, it's impossible for him to become a man. And they say, therefore, Jesus could not have been God before he was man because we don't believe it. See? Well, how many people believed that the world was flat for how long? And when Copernicus came up with it's round, and when Galileo verified it, the hierarchy was ready to do him in. So Galileo was wise. He came before the council and he said, okay, I will believe and endorse what the council says. Then it's reported that as he was walking out, he said, nevertheless, it is still round. See. So what people believe that is not a true definition in the Bible is neither here nor there. Because people can believe error and they can believe things that are wrong with the exact same intensity that you believe that something is right. The only difference being is God requires you to prove all things, search the scriptures to find out whether they are so, and hold fast to that which is good. God does not want you to have a blind belief that you do not know, that you do not understand. He wants you to have a belief that is understandable. He has made it and defined it in the scriptures so we can understand it, you see. Now let's look at some other scriptures here which will help us along the way. Let's come to Genesis, the second chapter here. God created man, created Eve. Now, how did God appear to them? If God was a glob, did he talk to them out of a tree, out of the ground? He should have talked to them out of the fruit, don't you think? That would have helped Eve a little bit, you know. Don't eat this one, Eve. See? How did he appear? He appeared as a man. What did he look like? Now, that's the right answer, a man, yes. See? Probably looked very similar to Adam. See? Because if he made Adam in his image, then he must have looked very similar to Adam. You see. So when God talked to them, they saw him. Now let's come over to chapter 3 and verse 8. And they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden. Now it wasn't his voice. They heard his voice as God was walking in the garden. You know, have you ever seen a voice walking? It looks like a millipede. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. In the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. Now, if God is in everything, then hiding in the trees wouldn't help, would it? See? So the Lord God called unto Adam and said to him, where are you? So he had to come out and say, well, I'm here. Well, you know the rest of the story. You come all the way through the things up to the time of Noah and including Noah. And you find that God was living in the Garden of Eden. He cut it off so that Adam and Eve and no one else could go there. He probably had the altar for the burnt offerings right at the entrance of the Garden of Eden. And that's why the temple and the tabernacle are made the way that they are, because it goes back and reflects how things were at the time that God created man. So man was put out of the garden. He could not come into the Garden of Eden, but he could come up to the point where the altar of burnt offerings was, and that's where they came and worshiped God. That's where they came and met God. Now, we will see that this is the God who became Jesus Christ. We'll see that in a little bit. But through the first part of Genesis, God walked with man, talked with man, executed judgment against man, and so forth. After the flood, God removed himself from walking and talking with man and appearing as a human being. And he gave the jurisdiction of judgment to men. Now we find that in Genesis, the 9th chapter. Genesis 9. And he says here, verse 5, "Surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man." So here he gave them the jurisdiction of judgment, and this is, by the way, before the law given at Sinai, this is an administration of death, is it not? Yes, it is. The administration of death did not begin under human hands with Israel and the judges. It began with Noah and his sons after the flood. Then God made a covenant with the whole earth that he would never flood it again. Then we come to the time of Abraham, and we are not told that he appeared directly to Abraham all the time. We know that he appeared to him in visions, but there were occasions when he appeared to him directly. Now let's come to Genesis 18 and we'll see this. And how did he appear? Was he a glob rolling down the road, just, you know, kind of like a inner tube or something like that? What was he? What did he look like? Okay. What did he do? Now, Genesis 18. Verse 1. "And the Lord appeared to him," that is Abraham, "in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him." Okay. Now, let's understand something. We'll give you a little lesson in philo-trinityology. Okay. Philo, who was the famous Jewish Alexandrian philosopher who married together pagan philosophy and the Bible by interpreting the Bible in an allegorical sense. Now, we'll come back to the allegorical sense in a little bit, or in a sense that looks at the plain, simple statements of the Bible and says it doesn't mean exactly what that says. It really means something else. So therefore, here's what it means. So he says of these three men that this is the Trinity. Okay? God, three in one. Because God appeared and lo, three men stood by him. Well, the three men were whom? One was the Lord, as we will see, and the other two were the angels, the two angels who went down. Look over at Genesis 19 and verse 1. "And there came two angels to Sodom." One was the Lord, the other two were angels, and they appeared as men. Now let's come back to Genesis 18 and continue. And when he saw them, now he literally saw them, this was not a vision. He ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground and said, "My Lord." Notice that is capitalized. Okay? That is not Lord with a small L meaning just a man. This means God. Okay? "If now I have found favor in your sight, pass not away, I pray you, from your servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree." Well, he was a little nicer than Simon the Pharisee we talked about yesterday. Okay? "And I will fetch a morsel of bread, and you comfort your hearts, and after that you shall pass on. For therefore you are come unto your servant." And they said, "So do as you have said." And Abraham hastened to the tent unto Sarah and said, "Make quickly 3 measures of fine flour, knead it, make cakes upon the hearth." Now wait a minute, God is going to eat bread. See, this has nothing to do with the God of Judaism that is a glob who is in everything. And by the way, that philosophy carried out one step further is the philosophy of Hinduism, that then you improve your godly character by reincarnation into different forms of life so that you can be purged of all of the nonsense of humanity and enter into the bliss of knowing God. And the ultimate bliss of knowing God, as Deepak Chopra says, is yourself. See, because God is in everything, God is in you. So therefore, you discover the God in you, and you have discovered God, and you know God. That's the whole point of all of this improve yourself movement. Tap the inner powers of yourself and all that sort of thing. So let's go on here. We'll have a little few diversions as we go just to fill you in on some of the nonsense that people believe. It's amazing what people believe. So Abraham, he ran under the herd. Now this is going to take some time. We'll ask Glenn about this because he's used to slaughtering animals. We'll see. You just figure out how much time this probably took when this went on. To do the bread, to knead it, to get it ready. If they're unleavened bread, well then that wouldn't take too long. Probably what, 20 minutes? You're ready to go? Okay. Now we got a bigger thing here, don't we? Ran into the herd, he fetched a calf tender and good, gave it unto a young man, and he hastened to dress it. And he took butter and milk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them. Now, one of the rules of kosher is that you never eat butter or drink milk with meat, and you'd never have them on the same plates or use the same utensils. So therefore, you have 2 sets of plates, 2 sets of silverware, 2 sets of pans, etc. Now then, God violated Jewish kosher law. See, it's amazing what people believe. He took the buttermilk and the calf which he had dressed and set it before them. Well, obviously then it took time to cut it and roast it. Now I don't know what part they cut and roast, but I just imagine that they got the loins and the ribs, and I imagine they had something like, you know, what we call New York steak today, only roasted. Now, how long would that take to roast? Let's figure the whole thing here. How long would it take to slaughter one of those animals and dress it out. In haste, 4 or 5 minutes?
45 minutes.
45 minutes. Okay. All right, then you cut it up. That would take, some minutes anyway. In order to get the ribs, you've got to hack down the back. There's no way around that. So let's say a half hour to dress it after they've skinned it, dress it, get the parts cut up. So we're looking at an hour and a half. Then we're probably looking at what? An hour and a half to roast it? Somewhere around there? Okay, so we're looking at approximately 3 hours in the whole thing. See? And all the while they were sitting there in the tent. Now then, after he set it before them, verse 8, and he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. And they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? And he says, behold, in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return unto you according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah your wife shall have a son. And Sarah heard it in the door of the tent which was behind him. And Sarah and Abraham were old, well stricken in age, and it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being old also? And the Lord said to Abraham, wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I of a surety bear a child when I am old? Now notice verse 14. It's a key verse. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Okay. In other words, is it impossible for God to become a man? Of course not. Okay. Not impossible. If people do not believe it, that does not make it a fact. The fact of it stands by itself, regardless of what people believe. Okay, that's why we have the Bible. Now let's go to the very time when Jesus was conceived. Let's go to Luke, the first chapter. Because you see, the essence of this book is that Jesus did not exist until the instant that he was conceived in Mary's womb. Now they do believe in a miraculous conception. And I suppose that's supposed to give them validity for the rest of what they believe, which is nonsense. Now let's pick up the account here. Let's pick it up here beginning in verse 30. And this is Gabriel, the angel, Luke 1 and verse 30. Luke 1 and verse 30. And the angel said to her, fear not, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you shall conceive in your womb and bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He shall be great, shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his David, of his father David, and that actually means forefather. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Now that ties in with Isaiah the 9th chapter, though it's not an exact quote. Then Mary said unto the angel, how shall this be, seeing I know not a man? And the angel answered and said to her, the Holy Spirit shall come upon you, and the power of the Highest shall overshadow you. Therefore, that also, that the holy thing which is or shall be born of you shall be called the Son of God. Now, it actually means that which is being begotten in you right while he was speaking, present tense passive, shall be called the Son of God. And behold, your cousin Elizabeth, she has also conceived a son in her old age, and this is the 6th month with her, who was called barren. Now notice verse 37, key verse. For with God, nothing shall be impossible. Okay? Nothing shall be impossible. Now, I've noticed that in this book they don't quote any of those scriptures. So we'll just make note of that as we go. Okay. Now, let's come to John, the first chapter. John, the first chapter. We're all going to speak a little Greek today, and I'll make it easy for you. And let's understand something concerning the book of John, but especially the writings of John. His Greek is very simple and straightforward. And the reason that God inspired it to be that way is so that we won't get complicated with the philosophies of men. Now, as we covered yesterday, that the disciples were not of this world, that they were considered by the learned, educated people of the scribes and Sadducees and Pharisees to be ignorant and unlearned men. So they were not steeped in the philosophies of Judaism, and God always preserved a core of scriptural believers that he reserved to himself, which he probably did with all of those involved to be called to be apostles with Mary, etc., that they believed they were scripturalist. That's why I did the series Scripturalism versus Judaism, see. Because Jesus did not come out of Judaism. He rejected it, had no philosophies of Judaism. The disciples who became apostles did not come out of Judaism. They were not thoroughly Jewish to the core. As a matter of fact, the only one who was thoroughly Jewish to the core was Judas Iscariot. All of the other 11 came from the area of Galilee. Fishermen, tax collectors, and whatever else the other ones had for their occupations before they began to follow Jesus, you see. Living in Galilee, you know what Jerusalem thought of Galilee? You know what they said? Never has it been heard that a prophet comes out of Galilee. See? In other words, can anything good come out of Galilee? See? Now, they were educated in Greek. They spoke Greek. They wrote Greek. And God intended that. Nowhere is there any evidence of any remnant of any of the Gospels, including Matthew, that was ever written in Aramaic or Hebrew. It's just not so. Though people have made claims that it was. Now, the reason that it was in Greek was because that was the language that the people spoke. And the reason that it was not written in Hebrew was because Greek is the foundation for all the modern languages that we have today. And Greek is still a living language, and Greek is still read in the Greek churches from the same text that we are reading here. However, they've done the same thing as all the other religions. They have cocooned the Bible and put it in their little altar sanctuary, and the only time they open it is when they have Sunday services or Mass, whatever they have with the Orthodox Church, and the only time they get close to it then is when they kiss it. And through this device, God preserved the Byzantine text. Though they had it right in their hands, though they had it with them, after the New Testament church was scattered into the area of what later became known as the Waldensians, the Bible was literally locked up because it was so holy that only the priest ought to read it and only the priest ought to interpret it. Well, the Catholics did the same thing with the Latin Vulgate Bible from Jerome. Okay. Now, this Greek is very easy. Now, first of all, I'm going to read it in the English, and then we'll all be able to say some Greek words here. Then I'll explain it to you afterwards. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay? Now, it's very simple Greek. I will say it, you listen to me, and then repeat after me when I tell you to repeat. Okay? En arche. Ready? En arche. That's in the beginning. En hologos. Ready? En hologos. That means was the Word. Ki hologos. Ready? Ki hologos. That means and the Word. Okay? En proston theon. I'll repeat that. En proston theon. Ready? En proston theon. Now that means was with God. And the structure of the Greek is so clear that there can be no doubt as to what this is saying. None whatsoever. Now let's finish it. Okay. Ki theos. Ready? Ki theos. That means and God. Then en hologos. Ready? En hologos. And that means that the Word was God. Now, if you looked at this in an interlinear, and you probably read somewhat about it, people make a big deal concerning the fact that there is no definite article for theos when it says, and the Word was God. With the article, theos is pronounced this way, ho, which then means the. Theos, God. Here it is just, Ketheos en hologos. Now, the reason that the definite article is not there is because what this is conveying in the Greek means this. It means that the Word is everything that God is. Every attribute of God, it is equal with God, and so forth. So that's why there is no definite article there. Okay? And that's, is, if you studied elementary New Testament Greek, you would get to about your fourth lesson and you would be able to understand this with no problem. That's how basic and elementary that this part of the New Testament is with the introduction. See? Now then, let's continue on with this, and we'll look at some other things concerning Christ becoming a man. Now, we're going to go ahead and go all the way down to verse 14, and then I'm going to read to you some quotes out of the book that Anthony Buzzard and Charles Hunting have written. Okay. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now let me tell you about the word with. This Greek word is pros. So when it's pros ton theon, it means with God. Now, it is a reflection of that God and the Word were face to face because the word face is prosopon. Pros with means facing. Now there's another word which means with, which is meta. is this is not metta, this is pros. And so when you read in the other parts, there's a couple of sections in the New Testament where it is face-to-face. It is pros open, pros, pros open, face-to-face. So when you have it here that he was with God, that means that he had a close relationship akin to face-to-face. Now, the reason I'm bringing this out is because, as we will see, they believe that this word is equivalent to wisdom in Proverbs, the 8th chapter. So you see, whenever there is a false doctrine that goes contrary to what the scriptures plainly say, they must go to an outside source, they must leave the meaning of the original language, and they must create a brand new translation, which we will see that they did. That's why I wanted to go through this, and so you would see that it's very simple. It means what it says, and it says what it means, and there is no equivocation, period. Now, verse 2. He was in the beginning with God. Now, all things came into being through him. Now, how can all things come into being through him if he did not come into being until he was conceived in the womb of the Virgin Mary? You see, that creates a great difficulty. So they explain it, well, it was made for him. But that's not what it says. Now notice, John makes it even more clear, continuing now. And not even one thing that was created came into being without him. In him was life, and the life was the light of the world. Well, you see, we're dealing with something very important, aren't we? Only God can impart life. Is that not true? Look at everything that man has done in this modern age. He still cannot make it live. He can make a robot, he can make it appear, but he cannot make it live. Because life has to come from life, and man does not have the ability to bring that kind of life. In him was life, verse 4, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines into the darkness, but the darkness does not comprehend it. Now we're talking, the light is shining into the darkness of what? Satan's world. And the darkness doesn't comprehend it. Now then he picks up with the baptism of John. There was a man sent by God whose name was John. He came as a witness that he might testify concerning the light, so that through him all might believe. He was not the light, but came that he might testify concerning the light. The true light was that which enlightens everyone who comes into the world. Now, you tie that together with everything that was made and the light. What we are talking about here is that Christ is the one, as creator, who gives intelligence to all men coming into the world. That's what it's talking about. Verse 10, he was in the world. Now to make sure we know who he's talking about, he says, and the world came into being through him. It was not for him, but through him. But the world did not know him. He came to his own, because he was to be of the house of David, of the tribe of Judah. And his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, To them he gave authority, not says power in the King James, but the Greek there is exousios, meaning authority, to become the children of God. Even to those who believe in his name, who were not begotten by bloodlines, nor by the will of the flesh, nor by the will of man, nor but by the will of God. And the Word became flesh. Now let's understand something. If he did not exist until he was conceived, he was always flesh, correct? So how could he become flesh if that's what he always was? If he didn't exist until he was conceived in Mary's womb. You see the great problems you have with that. See? The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, let me read a quote here, and let's see how they explain some of these things. And I thought that Anthony's first booklet was bad. This book is something else. Okay. Now this is concerning the things concerning John here. Okay. No. Let's pick up something here on page 178, which says, in the synoptics, now he's quoting someone, historians agree that this is so. In the synoptics, there is no direct statement of the pre-existence of Christ. Now, synoptics means Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay. They do not anywhere declare his pre-existence.